Today, as we wear our poppies to help us remember those who died during two world wars, as well as about 16,000 more people who have been killed in conflicts since 1945, I'd like to share with you a remarkable story from the Pacific. And I think the map is coming up on the screen any minute now for us to follow that progress. This time, of course, it's not my story. It's a story from the 1940s, and it was told to me by two of the ex-missionaries, both very good friends who've now passed away, the story of how they escaped from the Solomon Islands to Australia on a small mission boat during the Second World War when the Japanese invaded the islands. What I hope you can see there on the screen is you can see the Solomon Islands up at the top there, and particularly marked out there for you is the island of New Georgia, which is the area that they started from, and then the route across to Australia, and again particularly marked is the Great Barrier Reef and the town of Mackay on the coast of Queensland in North Australia. Now, the Second World War had an enormous impact on the Solomon Islands and all through the South Pacific. It totally disrupted and changed the way of life for people, as first of all the Japanese invaded, and then the Americans, with the Australians, New Zealanders and so on, retook the islands. And some of the most decisive battles of World War II were fought on and around the island of Guadalcanal, which, if you can see at the top there, is the island that's actually got Solomon Islands written on it there. I think people do remember the name of Guadalcanal from the war. And perhaps not so many remember the name of New Georgia, but there was certainly a great deal of fighting in New Georgia as well. And that is where, before the war, and again today, the headquarters of the United Church in Solomon Islands is. It's a story of God's wonderful guidance and care and keeping, and a story of how all those involved were very conscious of God's presence with them right throughout everything that happened. Now, after the fall of Singapore, the Japanese moved surprisingly quickly through Papua New Guinea and then southwards towards the Solomon Islands. And it was a very confusing time for those people in the Solomons. It was a confusing time for the missionaries, who received only little bits of news about what was going on where. It was hard to keep up with the story of what was happening in other places. But when they did get some definite news, it was not good news. It was the news that the capital, Tulagi, in those days, the capital had been bombed and by the Japanese, and that the last boat evacuating people to Australia, evacuating the expatriate people to Australia, had already left the Solomons. So they either had to stay and face the Japanese, or they had to try and make some bid to escape. And faced with that choice, they decided, not without a lot of thought and prayer, they decided that they should try to get away to Australia on the only thing available, which was the small mission boat called the Faro Chief. There were six missionaries, and there were five other people that they collected up, traders and so on, who also needed to get away. The problem was, of course, that although the boat was there, none of them were really sailors, and only one out of the whole group knew how to use the boat's engine. Another problem was that the only navigational aid they had for crossing a big chunk of the Pacific there was an old copy of a school atlas. Now that's not very helpful when it comes to finding your way. Anyway, they decided that they would use it and they'd have a go. And they decided that if they set a course for Australia, if they headed roughly southwest, Australia was a big place and they could hardly miss it. The trouble was, of course, that on the same basis, if they headed roughly southwest, the Barrier Reef, the largest coral reef in the world, runs all the way down that northeast side of Australia, and sooner or later they were going to hit that too. Not too literally, they hoped. They could hardly miss that either. They were given one other possible navigational aid by an old sailor, and that was a sextant. But again, the problem was nobody really knew how to use a sextant. So they decided to have a try and see if they could take a sighting with it and work out position. Well, they did have a try, and they tried to work out their position, and they discovered that, according to that, they're working out, their position was somewhere in the middle of Australia. Okay, that wasn't successful. They had a second try, and they found that they were supposed to be somewhere in the middle of Africa. At that point, they gave up altogether, I think, and threw the sextant away, decided that wasn't going to be any help. So despite all of that, they set out for Australia. Most of them quickly got seasick, and that continued to be a problem all through their journey. On the second day out, the engineer's wife had been preparing something for them to eat, those who wanted to eat. She'd been preparing some soup, and she was standing at the back of the boat near a rather low rail. And unfortunately, at that moment, the boat gave a sudden lurch. The rail caught Monica right behind her knees, and she went backwards into the sea. A shout went up, and knowing that she couldn't swim, her husband, Bert, rushed and dived in to go and save her. The boat continued to sail on, and the problem was that Bert was the engineer, the only person who knew how to deal with the boat's motor. At that precise moment, the doctor was the one who was steering the boat. So he managed to turn it round so that they could go back and find Bert and Monica. And it was the minister who found a suitable lever to pull, and after a few sparks, the boat finally came to a stop. Now, while all that was going on, another one of the people, Ernie, was having his bath on the deck. They'd rigged up a piece of canvas so that people could use it and get behind and have their bath. And Ernie was having his bath on the deck. When he heard the shout, "Man overboard," or perhaps "woman overboard," whichever it was, he came dashing round from his behind his piece of canvas in the middle of his bath, just as he was, without anything at all on, rushed and managed to untie the life belt after a bit of a struggle, and he jumped into the sea with the life belt to rescue Bert and Monica. And it wasn't until afterwards that it emerged that Ernie couldn't actually swim either. Anyway, pretty brave. Fortunately, they managed to rescue Bert and Monica and get them back on board. Meanwhile, some of the other women on the boat had been below where they were lying down and being rather seasick when all this happened. And of course, when it happened, they realised quickly something was wrong and went up on deck to see what was going on. And they were very interested in the proceedings. As they stood and watched all of this happening, they wondered why Ernie was so reluctant to get out of the sea himself at the end of it all. But they got the whole thing sorted out, and fortunately, without any loss of life there. And they went on for a while without having any more major incidents. On the Sunday, they had their own service on board the boat, conducted by the minister. And then after some more days, they woke up to discover that they'd sailed through a gap in the reef. And from then on, they were caught up with the Great Barrier Reef, and they had to try and thread their way through the coral. Now, of course, the Great Barrier Reef is not just one straight bit of coral. It's lots of different bits of reef with deeper water in between. So it was a question of trying to find the gaps and navigate through. And that was a process that could take a lot of time and was rather dangerous to do, and it dangerous especially at night when they couldn't see properly where they were going and what was going on. One night they did run onto a piece of reef, and they spent a very anxious time with the boat being damaged by the waves. But finally they were able to get across that piece of reef and anchor in some deep water on the other side. All this time, as they tried to navigate through the reef, they didn't see any other boats at all, which even during wartime is a rather bad sign if you're trying to navigate your boat. Nobody else was going that way. And then a sudden and very severe storm struck. The winds were very strong, and it was at that point they did begin to think, we may not make this. The storm was so severe that even with the anchor down and the boat running full throttle, it was almost impossible to keep the boat drifting and safe. And the boat was literally shaking itself apart. Now at that point, Clary, the minister, tried to write a message and put it in a bottle and throw it overboard in the hope that somebody would find it and learn what had happened to them if they didn't get through in time-honoured sailor's fashion. But one of the people on the boat told everybody that he believed that the storm was going to stop at 12 o'clock midday. They were all completely surprised when that is exactly what happened. To their amazement, the wind stopped really suddenly. They said it was as though the wind had been just cut off by a knife. It completely stopped. The sea was calm again. They were hopeful again that they would actually manage to complete their journey. They cleared up the boat, fastened things that were loose and missing and so on, and went on. And at last, they saw some land ahead. There were some small islands, and on one of them, there was a lighthouse. They made for the lighthouse, and they found that it was a manned lighthouse. There were two keepers there. All of them were absolutely delighted to reach some solid land after 15 days at sea. The lighthouse keepers were very surprised at their arrival. They said to them, "We've been watching all day the boat coming, and we've never seen anybody coming that way before. We thought you were the boat with the beer." Well, they were a bit disappointed, but the missionaries were not. And after a brief stop at the lighthouse, they had a chance to have a wash, they had a chance to have something to eat, and they asked the lighthouse keepers to direct them through the next bit of the reef to the coast of Australia, which they did. And they arrived at the small town of Mackay on the Queensland coast. They anchored offshore when they arrived there, and they tried to do the things that they were supposed to do. So they put up a yellow flag to show that they didn't have health clearance, and they put up a flag upside down to show that they were in distress. And they waited for somebody to make contact with them. They were, of course, approaching the coast of Australia, and it was in wartime, and they didn't want to be mistaken for anybody else. So they waited, and they waited. And they waited half a day, and despite the fact that there was a war on, nobody took any notice of them at all, anchored off there. So finally, they gave up, and they sailed into the harbour, and they tied up. And then people started taking notice. They promptly came and told them that this was a secret naval establishment. They had no business at all to be there. And didn't they know there was a war on? What were they doing? Well, finally, they were able to tell their story. And once they started to tell their story, everyone came to their rescue. The Red Cross came. The ambulance came because one of the people on board was quite seriously ill. The customs came, everybody arrived. They didn't have passports. They only had basically the clothes that they stood up in. But everybody, they said, couldn't possibly have been kinder. They were taken to a hotel and they were looked after. And when everything had been explained, and they'd done their sorting out, the missionaries were cared for by the local Methodist church. The local Methodist church finally arranged for them to go by train to Sydney and then to fly across home to New Zealand. And before they left, the church organised a farewell meal for them. At the end of the meal, the minister, Reverend Potter, told them that on the previous Sunday, at the end of the morning service, he'd felt a sudden compulsion to pray for missionaries coming back from the Solomon Islands. Now, he knew absolutely nothing about them. He knew nothing about their journey. He didn't know who they were, and he'd no idea that they had set out from the Solomon Islands even. But he felt this so strongly that at the end of the Sunday morning service, instead of finishing at the benediction, he kept the congregation standing and told them that they were going to pray together for missionaries coming back from the Solomons, which they did before they completed the service. And when the missionaries heard this, of course, they remembered that that previous Sunday, at exactly 12 o'clock, the time of the end of the service, that was the time when the wind had stopped and the sea had calmed so miraculously, so totally unexpectedly. Well, none of the missionaries and none of the folk at the Methodist Church at Mackay needed any more convincing that prayer is effective. Real believing prayer, especially when a group of people agree to pray for something specifically together, is very effective. They simply took Jesus at his word when he told his followers, as we read in John's Gospel chapter 14, "I will do whatever you ask in my name, so that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If in my name you ask me for anything, I will do it." And the group were also totally convinced that God could be trusted to look after his people, convinced that God cares for them as he also cares for us. Whatever the problems, the dangers, the difficulties they had to face. Now, for us, of course, it may not be crossing a war-torn Pacific Ocean. Hopefully, for most of us, it's never going to be something quite that drastic. But all of us do have to cope with difficulties and dangers and problems in our daily lives. Maybe problems in the family, problems of sickness or bereavement, or loneliness, or unemployment, or whatever it happens to be. Whatever it is, we can be confident that God's power to help us is still the same as it today as it was 65 years ago during the war, or even before that, as we read in Psalm 91. God says, "I will save those who love me and will protect those who know me as Lord. When they call to me, I will answer them. When they are in trouble, I will be with them." We have a God who is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And when we realise that God is in control of things, the things which affect us, then I think we can follow Paul's advice to the people in Philippi in his letter to them, his advice not to worry. Don't worry about anything, but in all your prayers, ask God for what you need, always asking him with a thankful heart. So why don't we need to worry? Well, because we can take things to God in prayer, and because God has also promised that he will be with us, and he will be with us always, whatever's going on. He will be there for us if we let him, through the good times in life and when the going gets rough. It's as the psalmist wrote in Psalm 16, "I am always aware of the Lord's presence. He is near and nothing can shake me. And so I am thankful and glad, and I feel completely secure." When they left the Solomons by boat, the missionaries were quite concerned about whether or not they were doing the right thing. Should they run away from the situation and save themselves and leave the Solomon Islanders with whom they were working to face whatever was coming by themselves? Or should they stay and face it alongside the people that they were working with? If they had done that and faced the future there, that future would almost certainly have involved internment, at least, and very probably death. A good number of the missionaries working in that area were killed during the war. When this group finally arrived back in New Zealand, after what was for most of them their first ever plane ride, because there were no boats taking people from Sydney across to New Zealand in wartime, they did apparently receive some criticism from some of the church folk about leaving their posts in the Solomons. And this was very upsetting for them, in fact. But looking back later, the thing that helped to convince them completely that they had done the right thing in leaving was the fact that after the war, every single one of those who escaped on the boat returned to the Solomons in one capacity or another, returned to help to restore, rebuild, serve the church, and serve the people there again. And they returned, of course, very sure that they were serving a powerful God who is Lord of all, who has control over people and control over events, a God who has his own plans for his people, and a God who can be completely relied on. Because, as we're going to sing together shortly, the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. God's faithfulness is great. We've already sung about that in our first hymn. As great today for us here and now as it was during the Second World War. God has his own plans for us as individuals and churches and communities. But despite all this, we know that God doesn't force those plans on us. He's left us free to choose to follow him and to love him. He's shown us how much he loves us by sending Jesus to die for us so that the wrong things that we do can be forgiven, and we can invite Jesus to be our Lord, and we can look to follow his way. As we remember today those who gave their lives in wartime so that we can enjoy the freedom and life that we have today, let's also remember the fact that Jesus gave his life for us too, so that we can enjoy life in all its fullness, eternal life, starting here and now. And it's when we do this that God is able to answer our prayers, to help us through life's rough times, and to keep his promise to be with us always.